It's time for Hoosier History Live, weekly adventure through Indiana history with author, historian, and connoisseur of all things Hoosier, Nelson Price. The call-in number is 317-788-3314. And now on to Hoosier History Live.
Good afternoon and welcome to Hoosier History Live. I'm your host, Nelson Price. Today, our spotlight is going to be on a notorious aspect of our heritage. During the late 1930s, as the country moved toward involvement in World War II, there were Nazis residing in Indianapolis. German heritage family members living on the Near East Side were closely associated with a German-American Bund, an organization formed to follow the ideals of Adolf Hitler's Nazi Party. After Indianapolis newspapers published stories indicating that the East Side family planned to host organizational meetings, rocks were thrown at the family's house. The aftermath and activities of the family members were in the newspapers several times during the late 1930s. The German heritage family included three young adult children, all of whom had attended Tech High School. The family also had a connection to Brown County, where they bought extensive acreage, apparently to be the setting for a camp for Nazi sympathizing activities. To share details about all of this, I'm joined in studio by Al Hunter, the history columnist for the Weekly View newspaper that covers the east side of Indianapolis. Al has described the activities of these Nazis in Indy in a two-part series of recent columns. Al also is an author and is well known for his history tours, including popular walking tours of Irvington during Halloween season. It's always a pleasure to say welcome to Hoosier History Live, Al.
Thanks. Glad to be here again.
Yeah, terrific to have you back on the show. To elaborate, Al has been a guest several times on Hoosier History Live, including on shows about the Lincoln funeral train as it came through Indiana. Al's a Lincoln enthusiast and is just reminding me he has two books out related to Lincoln. He's also been on a show about H.H. Holmes, the notorious serial killer during the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, who unfortunately lived in Irvington for a while. Today's show about the Nazi sympathizers also is a look at an unsavory chapter. Al's columns about the family and their activities during the late 1930s, as well as before and after that era, provided much new information, even for me. I was aware of some of the history of the house because after World War II, my grandparents unwittingly bought the house without knowing anything about the distressing activities of the notorious previous owners. The house has long been demolished. Al and I will share about that. Also, during today's show, we'll have a trivia mystery with a prize to a listener who gets on the air with the correct answer. Then later during the show, listeners will have the opportunity to call in and ask questions of my guest and me. So, Al, to start us off, could you explain briefly how you learned about this multi-generational Nazi family and their activities in Indiana? Were you looking at old newspapers from the late 1930s?
Well, most of my columns are East Side-centric, Irvington-centric. And this particular column has been in the can, so to speak, for about 10 years, just waiting for a time for me to flesh it out and write it. And it seemed like a good time to do it. My dad, Robert Eugene Hunter, was a 54 graduate of Arsenal Tech, as was my Uncle Bill a couple years later. And this is a story about Arsenal Tech and the East Side. I decided now was a good time to run it.
All right. Well, to set up the local scene, let's first describe the national organization that these Hoosiers belonged to. It was called the German American Bund, B-U-N-D. Al, can you describe what it was and their beliefs?
The Bund was an organization that was trying to espouse Nazi beliefs. They didn't call them Nazi beliefs. They called it an America First movement. The idea was, make no mistake about it, it was for Aryan dominance and Aryan return, strongly anti-Catholic.
Anti-Semitic.
Favored Jim Crow laws. favored the Chinese Exclusion Act. Just about anything that you could imagine, they were against if it wasn't white.
Well, apparently the membership peaked nationally in 1938-39, which is also the time period we'll be looking at locally. I think your column had information about the peak of this Bund.
Yeah, the peak would have been 38-39. It went down quickly. It peaked with about 35,000 American members. And it should be remembered that at the time, the population of the country was 130 million. Roughly 13 million were German, considered themselves identified with Germans. And that's who they were going towards. Indianapolis, as you know, has a strong German background.
Yeah, I'm going to share some information about that. But the Bund had, I read in your column, the Bund, or your German accent is better than mine, but they had a huge rally in New York City in Madison Square Garden.
Absolutely, they did. And that it was an interesting event. Of course, Fiorello LaGuardia is the mayor of New York City at the time. Perfectly situated to kind of control this from the outside. And you've got it in Madison Square Garden, 20,000 people on the inside, 100,000 people on the outside trying to get in. LaGuardia had every cop in the city, every police officer, and every fireman out there. And the firemen stood at intervals holding hoses in their hands, aimed at the people trying to get in, to protect the people that were in there already. If you can imagine a stage, they staged it as a celebration of George Washington's birthday. The stage had a great big portrait of Washington above it, and their speaker, Fritz Kunz, got up there and said that he believed that Adolf Hitler and George Washington would have been good friends. No. I think George Washington would have kicked him in the seat of the pants and told him to get out.
Well, we might explain more about this later in the show, but as I understand it, once the United States entered World War II after the bombing of Pearl Harbor in December 1941, the Bund quickly disbanded.
It did. It was building, and people might not know or have forgotten that the America First movement was viewed as a patriotic movement, and it enlisted some very big names in the America First: Charles Lindbergh, Henry mm-hmm. Ford, Sergeant Shriver, Potter Stewart, Frank Lloyd Wright, Lillian Gish, Gerald Ford, and Eddie Rickenbacker, who has a tie to Indianapolis. All these people aligned themselves with the America First movement until they realized just exactly what type of person mm-hmm. Hitler was.
Well, let's focus in now on the Indianapolis family. They lived on the Near East Side and were members of this German-American Bund. The patriarch, the grandfather of the people we primarily will be focusing on, this grandfather was a German immigrant who, per your column, arrived here in the 1870s as a boy, and he founded a small chain of grocery stores in Indianapolis.
Yeah, named John Albert Soltau. He founded the Minnesota Grocery Company, which became Indianapolis's first grocery store chain, 12 total stores over the course of 50 years. He and his family lived in Woodruff Place and worshipped at the First Evangelical Church in Lockerbie Square. Mm-hmm. He was a constant candidate, first as a Republican for minor offices, never got elected. Mm-hmm. Then he aligned himself with the Prohibition ticket, ran a couple times, never got elected. And the Prohibition movement has been closely tied to some other nefarious groups mm-hmm. from that time, the KKK being one of them. We don't know exactly how he lined himself up with Nazism, but where he was deficient, his children were not.
Yeah, so he had five kids, and we're going to focus on William, the oldest. Again, the family name is Soltau, S-O-L-T-A-U. So this William Soltau and his kids, who are the ones that were living in this east, Near East Side house. William was a realtor?
He was a realtor, so he owned properties all over the state in central Indiana. So he owned this house. His office was in the Inland Building, not far from the Circle. Very well-known man, very well-connected. And as I say, he and his father, I don't really believe that they made a point out of their connection to anything other than the America First, but his children took a different point of view.
So, yes, he had these three children. That's who we're really going to focus on. A son, Charles, and Charles had two sisters. They all graduated from Tech High School in the 1920s and 30s. So Charles Saltow, the grandson, graduated from Tech, actually, per your com, in 1926, went to Purdue, graduated with honors, perfect GPA at Purdue. And now let's get to March 1938. That's the month when all this major activity happened. By then, Charles Saltow was 27. He's living with his two sisters and their parents in this house. The address was 339 North Summit Street on the Near East Side of Indianapolis. Al, can you explain the chain of events that thrust this house and their embrace of the Nazi ideology into the newspapers?
Well, the national publicity director for the Boone was a man named Wilhelm Fritz Kunz. He was on somewhat of a mini tour of the Midwest at the time. He'd come up from Chicago. And Charles, the middle son, decided that he wanted to be active in forming a chapter of the German-American Bund here in Indianapolis. And they went so far as to rent the Athenaeum, and the Athenaeum, once they found out who they were, they canceled the contract, and the Syrian mosque did the same thing. So he decided to have Fritz Kunz come down to his house at the address you just gave. And at first, news leaked out. I believe Charlie was the one that leaked the news out, much to the disdain of his father, who didn't want it known. He had a reputation to protect. So the father immediately said, no, we're not having, this is not happening. Well, Charles immediately started sending, for lack of a better term, press releases to the Indianapolis newspaper saying, yeah, we're having this. And they began to publish that this was going on.
And it was free and open to the public.
It was. Yeah. And to give you an idea of what the vernacular was, this is typical of one of the letters he said, you, Aryan, Nordic, and Christians, wake up and demand our government be returned to the people who founded it. It has always been very much American to protect the Aryan character of this nation. And he signed his letters as yours for a cleaned up white man's USA. So it's not hard to figure out where his allegiance lay.
Yeah, well, you already alluded to something I'm going to elaborate on a bit. Do you think the Saltows were assuming that the German heritage in both the city of Indianapolis and the state would mean there would be a base of acceptance for the Bund? I'm going to note from research I've done from my various history books, Germans after the 1850s became the largest European ethnic heritage group in both Indiana and the city of Indianapolis. At the end of the 1800s, 1899 into 1900s, 70% of the city population had some German heritage, and other cities in Indiana, notably Fort Wayne and Evansville, had even higher German percentages, and plus other smaller cities like Jasper, Oldenburg, deeply German heritage. So do you think that was part of their thinking, that we would have a base of support?
I'm sure it was. From what I've discerned, the family was a church-going, God-fearing family with Christian values that somehow or another became white Christian values. They saw the German-American Bund as something of their heritage, and they figured with such a strong German-American community in Indianapolis that people would come rushing to this and believe in this idea, because America First was all over the papers, all over the magazines, all over the airwaves back then, so they thought they had a winner. It turns out they did not.
Yeah, well, that's what I want you to explain here. Fortunately, the public reaction among Indianapolis residents was, I guess, anything but sympathetic. Describe the horrified reaction of Indianapolis people. The next day, rocks were thrown through their windows.
Yeah, once, because Charlie just wouldn't let it go. He kept going to the news media and saying, yes, we're having this, when his dad was like, don't push this thing. Word got out. People started appearing in the street in anticipation of this thing. He planned this boond meeting for a Monday night, March 14th at 8:30 p.m., obviously assuming that nobody's going to show up and nobody's going to pay attention at that late hour. But people were out there waiting. They were waiting to see who showed up for this meeting. There's no record of anybody seeing the meeting take place or begin. There is a record of it ending, and that their main speaker, Fritz Kuhns, came walking out only after threats had been made against the family, and assuming Fritz as well. And the father called the police, William called the police, to escort Fritz safely from his house. And Fritz wouldn't tell the police officers his name, and he hid his identity, even though he came walking out with the Adolf Hitler toothbrush mustache and a swastika tie bar. And in his hands were a bunch of Nazi propaganda. So it wasn't hard to figure out who this guy was. They'd heard of him, but he wasn't telling anything. Police took him down to the station. He finally admitted it. And after Fritz was removed, they put a police car out in front of that house from dusk till about 10:30, shift end. And at 10:30, when the police left, somebody started throwing rocks and breaking windows in this house. Very nice house, breaking the north windows of this house. And the police were called back, and the crowd was dispersed. But that didn't stop. And you and I are both newsmen, former newsmen, so we owe it to another newsman who his name is unknown. He went in and looked through the windows to see what was going on, saw the dining room table had 15 chairs, and in front of each chair was a stack of Nazi propaganda. Nobody really showed up for the meeting except the Soltaus and one little old man that they don't know who he was, and I assume he just showed up for the free cookies and cake. So it was very underwhelming.
But per your column, cars buzzed the house
cars
for days.
For days, and a gang of ruffians, teenage kids with nothing better to do, just roamed the neighborhood waiting for trouble to erupt.
All right. Well, coming up, more on our show exploring aspects of our history, an unsavory aspect. Nazi sympathizers who lived on the east side of Indianapolis in the years leading up to World War II. We're going to delve into what happened to this German heritage family when the draft was enacted. I'll also have my guest describe the family's connection to hundreds of acres in Brown County and what they wanted to create there. I'm joined in studio by Al Hunter, the history columnist for the Weekly View newspaper. Al recently found some advertising cards from the late 1930s that are revealing about some Americans' attitudes during that era, so I'll have him share details about that too. And I'm going to be posing our history mystery with a prize to a listener who gets on the air with the correct answer. So much more ahead coming up.
Hoosier History Live is underwritten in part by Story Inn, one inconvenient location since 1851, online at storyinn.com, and Lucas Oil, offering oil and fuel products. More at lucasoil.com.
We're back. If you're just joining us, it's Hoosier History Live. I'm your host, Nelson Price, on today's show. Our spotlight is on some Hoosiers who unfortunately embraced the notorious Nazi ideology during the late 1930s and 40s. The house of a German heritage family on the east side of Indianapolis, as we've just been explaining, was in the newspapers after their activities were revealed. The Soltau family were members of the German-American Bund, a pro-Nazi organization. They apparently hoped to recruit other Hoosiers. My studio guest is author Al Hunter, who's researched and written about the family for a multi-part series of columns in the Weekly View, the newspaper that covers the East Side. Al's well known for his history knowledge and in particular for his popular walking tours in Irvington during the Halloween season. Before hearing more from Al, though, I'm going to pose today's history mystery. I deliberately made it about a positive aspect of Hoosiers during the World War II era, a heroic one, in fact. I want to note today a listener who gets on the air with the correct answer to the question I'm about to pose will receive a prize pack. It will include four admissions to the Indiana History Center, courtesy of the Indiana Historical Society, and two tickets to a walking tour of Indy's notable and notorious people in downtown Indy, courtesy of Indiana Landmarks. Phone number to call if you think you know the answer to the question I'm about to pose is 317-788-3314. I'll repeat that after I pose the question. Here it is. Again, it's touching on a heroic aspect of Hoosiers in World War II. It's focusing on the USS Indianapolis, the Navy cruiser that was sunk by torpedoes from a Japanese submarine in 1945. Of the nearly 1,200 men and the ship's crew, only 317 ultimately survived the sinking in shark-infested waters. Only one of the survivors was actually a native of Indianapolis. After the war, he returned to his hometown and joined the Indianapolis Fire Department. For several years before his death in 2013, he was a public figure, sharing insights about the USS Indianapolis tragedy. He helped raise funds for the memorial we have now on the canal in downtown Indianapolis to the USS Indianapolis. So our question is, name the USS Indianapolis survivor whose hometown was, in fact, Indianapolis. Phone number to call if you think you know is 317-788-3314. Now, shifting back to my guest, Al Hunter. And Al, let's shift from a moment from our look at the family who embraced the Nazi ideology to you recently found a pair of advertising cards from 1938. You were telling me it was like a yard sale or something.
It's like a roadside flea market.
Yeah.
In Strawtown, Indiana. I'm sure many of your listeners know exactly what I'm talking about.
And the cards, Al even brought them to the studio with them. They're from the late 30s, and they kind of are enlightening about some of the attitudes about what was happening in Germany.
Well, it's serendipitous that I found them. I mm-hmm. wasn't looking for them. They just landed into my lap. And mm-hmm. They were cards for a 4th International Leica exhibit in the Hotel Lincoln in February of 1938. And on the back of each card was an essay written in pencil by a man named Robert W. Shoemaker, Jr. of Anderson, Indiana. I found that later. And as it happens, they were written almost at the exact same time as the incident in Indianapolis with Fritz Kunz. And they give a good example of what Americans were thinking then, not really knowing what their allegiance was. And if you'll allow me, I transcribed one part of it that I think
okay,
speaks.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Shoemaker says, "At the lowest ebb of a people's hope, they look to a leader, a strong, fearless, aggressive man. When this Superman is found, the people raise him to great heights as their leader. One must remember that a dictator or any other national leader has only the power that his people are willing to give him. That and that alone is the secret of a powerful man's ability to rule and bulldoze. Once the backing has failed, his power collapses, much as a top-heavy construction with a weak foundation." He is speaking of Adolf Hitler, but you can draw your own conclusions from
right.
that. And in the German vernacular, they call that an Übermensch, Superman.
Uh-huh, yeah. But there, I guess, there are a lot of Americans that felt like the way World War I ended kind of hamstrung Germany, and
it did. And you know, we talked about the America First movement, and that has the end of the America First movement actually predates Pearl Harbor, which you mentioned before. Mm-hmm. We can owe a lot of that to our own Wendell Willkie. You've done shows on Wendell Willkie, and people don't realize that in 1940, when he ran against FDR, he's a registered Democrat, and he was up against Taft, Vandenberg, and Dewey, all of whom were isolationists. Wilkie's strength was that he hated Adolf Hitler, hated him, and that's what got him the nomination. That election killed the America First movement. And we owe some of that to Wendell Willkie.
Oh, interesting. Well, we have callers for our trivia. Let's go to Greta. Greta, you're on the air now. Do you think you know the name of the survivor of the USS Indianapolis, whose hometown was Indianapolis, the Hoosier capital?
Unless I'm confused, his name was Louis Christoph.
Oh, no, that's not right, Greta.
Then he was recovered from a ship accident because he was in the Navy in World War II. So I thought it was World War I, but I guess it might have been World War II. I hope somebody else can remember.
Oh, well, I hope this survivor is not forgotten. He really became a public figure in Indianapolis, his hometown. He survived in World War II, the sinking of the USS Indianapolis, and crusaded for the creation of the memorial on the canal. So if you think you know, thank you, Greta. Sorry you weren't correct there. But if you think you know the name of the survivor, the phone number to call for our trivia prize is 317-788-3314. Let's return to the German Heritage family we were talking about, and how after it was revealed that they had embraced the Nazi ideology, the house on the east side of Indianapolis, 339 North Summit Street, was pelted with rocks, cars buzzed for days. So apparently that same year later, Charles Salto, the brother, and his sister Opal, they were undeterred, and they even visited Nazi Germany?
They did, and which was not unusual. They're high IQ, high-achieving students, sent there officially. And at that time, Hitler was trying to spread his propaganda in any way that he could, and certainly he would take advantage of doing that with a group of young Americans. So they made a big show of it. They met Himmler and Goebbels, and they saw
They Hitler. Met Hitler.
They, it's un, we'll never know, but they certainly saw Hitler. Uh-huh. Whether they met him or not, or whether Hitler just talked to them, it's very likely that Himmler and Goebbels met them, because that's what they were about. But coming back, that's probably what planted the seeds of this already strong inclination towards it anyway. That's probably what led them to live that type of a lifestyle for the rest of their lives.
All right. We have other trivia callers on, so let's see if we have not sure the name of our caller. We have a woman caller. You're on the air now. And what's your name, ma'am?
Yes, good afternoon. My name's Peggy.
Okay, Peggy. And do you think you know the name of the USS Indianapolis survivor who was from Indianapolis?
Well, I'll take a try here. John A. Rauschkolb.
No, that's not. That person might have been on the ship, but that's not the survivor that that fits the description and the trivia question. Is that person you're naming? Is it someone who was on the USS Indianapolis?
Well, he's a former Japanese naval aviator.
Oh, no. Well, sorry, Peggy. So again, listeners, I didn't think this would be this difficult because the person I have in mind did have quite a high public profile in the final years of his life as he lobbied for our USS Indianapolis Memorial downtown on the canal. If you think you know the name of this survivor of the attack on the submarine, the phone number to call is 317-788-3314. All right, well, back to Al again. So this Charles Soltau in 1940, from your column, he by then was 33 years old. He refused to report for induction into the draft.
That was pretty much the national mandate handed down from the German-American Bund, and he was just one of many. It just so happens that he was, it fit him perfectly. So he was a very proud Nazi espouser and happy to say, I can't kill my fellow Germans. I'm a German.
But he I guess the house was raided by U.S. Marshals, yeah. And he was arrested.
Yeah. Well, not just the house in Indianapolis, but the family was splitting time between a house in southern Indiana and Indianapolis. Both houses were raided, and they found it full of German propaganda. Nothing illegal, but definitely German propaganda, pictures of Hitler, swastikas, that sort of thing. And he still said, I'm not going. Into the draft, and they arrested him and threw him in jail. So it was very publicly.
Yeah, we're quoting for your column, or I can let you share this, what the judge said to him.
Yeah, the judge was not amused. He explained to him, I'm going to hand down the largest sentence I can possibly get my hands on. You're the worst defendant that has ever appeared before me.
Yeah, wow. Well, we now have callers on every line for trivia. So let's go to Gary. Gary, you're on the air now. Do you think you know the name of the USS Indianapolis survivor whose hometown was Indianapolis?
James O'Donnell, retired firefighter, Indianapolis Fire Department, Engine Company 25.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you. I didn't want Jimmy O'Donnell to be forgotten. How you even know the company he was with the fire department. How did you know
it? I've been involved in fire service for 39 years.
You were a firefighter, Gary?
Yes, sir.
Did you know Jimmy O'Donnell?
Not directly, but indirectly. I remember he came and spoke with the ROTC at Howe High School, uh-huh. And he was very adamant about getting a memorial. And back then, it was just talk. But the stories he's told, and a very humble person. I've met him a few times in passing, but I never knew him directly. But a very nice, very humble, very patriotic man.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Gary. You have won our trivia prize. So stay on the line, and our production engineer, Jake, will get your contact info, and then we'll send the prize to you. I am going to elaborate on Gary's answer. It's Jimmy O'Donnell. He was a native of Indianapolis who graduated from Tech High School. Jimmy O'Donnell was working at Allison when he was drafted into the Navy in 1944. He was assigned to the USS Indianapolis. There were nearly 1,200 men aboard the ship when it was torpedoed by the Japanese in July 1945. As Jimmy O'Donnell wrote in his autobiography, which was titled Only 317 Survived, he was the only survivor whose hometown was Indianapolis. The USS Indianapolis Memorial, thanks in part to large part to Jimmy O'Donnell, it was dedicated in 1995. Jimmy O'Donnell retired from the Indianapolis Fire Department as a lieutenant after a career of about 35 years as a firefighter. cancer. He died at age 92 in 2013. All right, well, returning now to our focus on this Nazi family, and Al, before we're describing what happened at their house on the Near East Side of Indianapolis, during the late 1930s, I think it was in that period, this family also purchased hundreds of acres, secluded acres, in Brown County. And apparently that was to create a camp for Nazi activities.
Well, that was the rumor. You'll never, you know, it will remain unproven, but that was the rumor because they knew their reputation. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. I know that they purchased their property on State Road 46 in the community of Nawbone, which every Hoosier knows Nawbone.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Nawbone, there's another kind of camp there, flourished for a long time. So they left Indianapolis, if I read your column correctly, they were gone by the time of Pearl Harbor, the attack, 1941, December 41.
Yeah, they had pretty much gone because of the negative publicity that their support of Adolf Hitler.
And then Charles, we noted, he was sent to jail. After he was released in 46, he and the sisters lived on that Brown County land.
Yeah, Pearl, his older sister, Charles, and Opal moved down there with the father. The father died on the farm down there in 1950.
And we'll talk about the later lives of Charles and these two sisters. I want to note a totally inadvertent connection my family had to the house on the east side of Indianapolis. The address was 339 North Summit Street. After World War II, in the summer of 1947, my grandparents, who had been living out of town elsewhere in Indiana without knowing its notorious previous owners, bought the house and lived in it with my father and uncle, who were teenagers. Decades later, my dad told me how they discovered German language newspapers and ham radio equipment. They couldn't figure out why all this was in the house. Finally, their neighbors filled them in and described how the house had been in the newspapers several times because of the activities that we've discussed with the previous owner's assault house. So, Al, when I started reading your column about the family and how rocks were thrown through the house, I knew it had to be the same place that I'd been told about. My cousin confirmed the Summit Street address. My grandparents later moved farther east to Irvington, which is where they were living when I grew up. So I pieced all this together. The house on Summit Street eventually was demolished, and there's a grocery store on the site for a while, and now it's a Mexican restaurant?
It's a Mexican bodega now, so.
Well, my theory is that, again, my grandparents bought the house in the summer of 1947. We just went over how the family was out of it in December 1941. So it must have sat vacant for 6 years or so. And I can't imagine there would have been any interim owners, because why would they have left German newspapers and ham radio equipment lying around? So my hunch is that because of the well-publicized notorious history of the house, it likely took a while to sell.
I think so. I think that's an accurate summation. The houses get reputations even to this day, and believe me, with my connection to Irvington, I know about house reputations.
Right. So they moved to their, Charles and his sisters moved to this Brown County land that they had, but this camp that the folklore was that they were hoping to develop, this camp for recruitment, it never happened. Again, fortunately, few Hoosiers apparently wanted to join this Nazi organization.
No, especially after Pearl Harbor and knowing that just about every family had someone fighting or dying in that
war. Right.
Very, very unpopular. Hitler just did not help himself.
Yes. Well, listeners, our phone lines are open. We've already got some callers coming in. Now our phone lines are open. So it is your opportunity to call in and ask questions or share comments and insights with my guest and me. Our spotlight today is on an unfortunate and notorious aspect of our history. During the late 1930s, there was support for the Nazis, a family living on the east side of Indianapolis. Newspapers wrote about how they were planning organizational activities at their house. Rocks were thrown through the windows and cars buzzed the house for days. Eventually, members of this German heritage family, as we just explained, moved to Brown County. They had bought hundreds of acres there, perhaps in the hopes of creating a camp for the German-American Bund. We'll be exploring what happened to the Soltau family, a brother and two sisters, later in life, what they did with this land in Brown County, and also what happened to some of the leaders of this Bund, whom they had hosted in Indianapolis. The phone number to call and join us on the air with questions and comments is 317-788-3314. That's 317-788-3314. So more ahead coming up.
Hoosier History Live is underwritten in part by Story Inn, one inconvenient location since 1851, online at storyinn.com, and Lucas Oil, offering oil and fuel products. More at lucasoil.com.
We're back. If you're just joining us, it's Hoosier History Live. I'm your host, Nelson Price. Today, we're time traveling to the World War II era and exploring Hoosiers who were members of a hate group, Nazi sympathizers who lived in a house that's since been demolished on the east side of Indianapolis. Hoosiers were appalled to learn that the family members were also, they were members of a national organization that supported the Nazi ideology. My guest is author and history columnist Al Hunter, who's described the Soltau family's activities in a series of columns in the Weekly View newspaper. Before we explain what they did with this land in Brown County where they moved, we have a caller, Russ, who's been patiently waiting. You're on the air now, Russ. Russ, will you turn off your radio? We're getting an echo effect. I think you have the radio on in the background. Russ, do we have you with us? I guess Russ has gone away. Well, anyway, listeners, you're welcome to call with questions and comments, 317-788-3314. So now let's explain back to Charles and his two sisters. We explain they lived on the east side of Indianapolis, graduated from Tech, then moved to Brown County on 200-plus acres there, but never developed this camp. Al, share what they did with the acreage.
Well, the first thing they did was they bought goats. and the newspaper reporters of the time described the farm as looking like, based on a Switzerland village, a Swiss village. They had bought Tragenberg goats imported specifically from Switzerland. And these goats were raised on a strict diet of alfalfa and cracked oats. Neighbors would drive from all over to get the milk and to get the yogurt. High quality. Pearl, Charles, and Opal each had their own tribe or trip of goats. They went from about 10 goats to close to 50, and they started a business they called the Pleasant Valley Goat Farm, where they would show up at farmers markets and festivals selling the yogurt and the milk of the goats. So.
And I guess from your columns, neither Charles nor his two sisters, Pearl and Opal, none of them ever married or had kids.
No, they were pretty much reclusive. If you wanted to talk goats, they were there to talk goats. But anything else was kind of just, they wanted to be left alone.
Uh-huh. So per your columns, Charles Soltau died in 1971 at age 61. Pearl died in 1968. Opal, who lived a lot longer, she remained committed to Nazi causes?
Opal was all in. She until the day she died, there were always rumors that of what she was up to. She mailed Nazi propaganda from the local post office down there, which didn't play very well. And by the 1990s, she found herself in Lincoln. She sold her property, moved to Lincoln, Nebraska, and worked with a neo-Nazi as an editor. Named Gary Lauck for his Nazi Battle Call magazine that had a following in the States, but the mistake was they mailed these to Germany, which is illegal.
Well, yeah, and she was mailing also, I guess, before she moved to Nebraska, mailing Nazi propaganda from a post office in Nashville, Indiana.
Nashville.
Was she arrested?
She was never arrested because she actually had a fairly good standing in that community. People trusted her enough to put her in charge of their, the elderly put her in charge of their assets, and she never she had a background in accounting, so she was trustworthy, and I think she was just kind of looked at as the local eccentric.
Okay, well, there's another Indiana city has connections with some of these other Bund organizers we mentioned earlier. One of them in 1941 was detained by police in South Bend, Indiana.
Well, that would be Fritz Kunz was the one that was was detained. Fritz had a big mouth, and he liked to say, make incendiary comments. He had a flair for developing colorful caustic nicknames for people and things, so he didn't stand himself in
good stead. Yeah, he had nicknames for like FDR.
Yeah, he called him Franklin Delano Rosenfeld. He called Fiorello LaGuardia Fiorello Jew Jumping LaGuardia, and he called the New Deal the Jew Deal. So he was.
Well, you can see the anti-Semitic aspect to all this.
Yeah.
All right. So he was arrested in South Bend.
He was. He was arrested, and ultimately deported, along with a group of other. I think that over 700 of them, these Nazi sympathizers, were. Deported, and the official records call these people unteachable Germans.
Were they deported to Germany?
They were sent back to Germany, and that's where they all died. Fritz Kunz was captured, actually, and he fled and ended up in Mexico City. He bought a 20-foot boat, and he started... told people he was just going to use it for fishing. Well, he started loading it with 200 gallons of fuel and 200 pounds of fish and just all these things that it began to look like the SS Minnow. And so they came in and they arrested him. He was going to take this 20-foot boat that really isn't ocean-worthy across to Germany. That's where he was going to escape, but they caught him before he did it.
They caught him and then deported him.
Yeah. They sent him to Sing Sing. Of all places, they sent him to Sing Sing, and that's where he was deported to Germany, ultimately.
Well, of course, it's a relief that Hoosiers apparently were appalled by this hate group, this Nazi-sympathizing German-American Bund during the 1930s. But you noted in your columns, Al, the track record in Indiana had not been the best. It was just over 10 years previously, during the 1920s, the notorious Ku Klux Klan had a stranglehold on Indiana, with estimates that nearly one-third of white Native American white native-born Hoosier men were members of the Klan in Indiana. So, and also, I guess, as per your columns, a brother of this, the patriarch of the Soltau family, was a member of the Klan.
Yeah, a man by the name of Benjamin Harrison Soltau. What a name.
Yeah.
He was a member of the Klan, and another was a member of Irvington Masonic Lodge 666. So they had strong ties to Irvington.
Right. So, I guess it's not a foregone conclusion, again, with the heritage aspect we described in the state, and then this track record that a relief that Hoosiers weren't nobody was sympathetic, apparently, to this.
That's what's one of the things that makes you proud to be a Hoosier, is these things, whether it was the KKK in Irvington that never, other than D.C. Stevenson, it never took root. And the same with Nazism in Indianapolis. I'm kind of proud of that.
Yes. Well, another aspect that we take pride in, I'm going to take the opportunity to note, this year is the 100th anniversary of the trial in 1925 when KKK leader D.C. Stevenson was convicted in the horrific death and rape of Irvington resident Madge Oberholzer. D.C. Stevenson, is, I think you just alluded to, he lived in Irvington, but his trial was in Hamilton County, Noblesville. So Hamilton County is commemorating the 100th anniversary with a series of events. They include events with our friend Charlotte Ottinger, who's written the definitive biography of Madge Oberholzer. Charlotte's been a Hoosier History Live guest multiple times. Anyway, this Klan era was rather recent history when these pro-Nazis were trying to generate support. So, well, I'm curious, Al, after you wrote your multi-part series about this pro-Nazi family that lived in Indianapolis, then Brown County, what kind of feedback did you receive?
The feedback is positive because they understood that they know the difference between writing a story and living a story, and it's people want to know these things, and this has been covered before in depth by others, but not necessarily the East Side Indianapolis aspect of it. And a lot of my readers have deep connections to Arsenal Tech. My own family has deep connections to Arsenal Tech. So they're interested to know that this went on. But Arsenal Tech, you know, that was a massive, massive school. Biggest in Indianapolis.
Yeah, it was the biggest high school in the state at the time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's just part of that life back then. You know, people can be wrong, and as long as they understand that there's a disparaging viewpoint out there, they can make up their own mind, and it's okay to be wrong.
Uh-huh. Well, for listeners who want to delve into this topic further, could you share some of the sources you recommend?
Well, sure. And Char, for point of clarification, Char's been a good friend of mine for many years.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Char would be interested to know that a lot of the Soltau families are buried not far from Madge Oberholzer in Memorial Park Cemetery. So, they're still there. They have roots there, pardon the pun.
Right.
My first introduction to this particular story came from a very good journalist by the name of Paul Mullins. I have met him many, many years ago. We have an IUPUI connection.
Yeah, he was a professor.
And I was a student, not a very good student, but I was a student. And I met him as he was a cyclist, as I remember, and that's how I met him. My uncle introduced me to him at the Major Teller Velodrome, and he and I had long debates over who had the best donuts in Indianapolis,
Rosalind,
Saps, or Long's. And he was the only other person that I had known, this is early on, that had a devotion to gummy bears. So what an interesting human being that man.
Well, he was an incredible trailblazing researcher on a range of local history topics, often unsavory aspects of our heritage. I had Paul Mullins on this show several times. And so he wrote a blog about these, I think it was called Nazis in the Heartland.
It was. But again, he didn't really necessarily focus on the East Side connection. Some things, as you well know, Nelson, some articles, some essays cannot be improved upon. So there's no reason to. And there are several out there that I wish I'd have written that story. Mm-hmm. Well, Paul's is of that vein. All I can do is update it and specialize it to my community, my paper,
and
my
readers.
And
then you just started researching the Soltaus?
I did.
Is that? Mm-hmm.
I did. And his blog is available. You can find it on the net. And it's worth a read. I'm a big newspaper fan, and I love to go and see what the old newspaper guys said about it. The photos of the Soltau family, we owe those to the newspapers. And the eyewitness accounts, we know we owe those to the newspapers. So I'm always going back and seeing what our fellow ink-stained wretches said about these people.
Yes. Well, thanks to Al, we have a photo of Charles Soltau on our Facebook page at Hoosier History Live. He's posing with Nazi memorabilia. That photo was originally in the newspaper?
It was. And if you go visit my my blog, there's a bunch of more photos of Soltau, the family, on it, under Alan E. Hunter. They all come from newspaper articles. Mm-hmm. Some of them, and in fact, there's a picture of one of his old grocery stores, which be interested to your listeners.
That chain died out,
yeah, it's
apparently.
Gone. It's
yeah.
Gone. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure it was sold, and it may have become something else, but it never made it past the the death of the dad and the petering out of the sons.
Yeah, and again, to reinforce what we alluded to earlier, Charles Soltau, the central figure in what we've been discussing, his sisters never married, no kids, so obviously no descendants or anything like that around.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're getting close to the end here. Al, is there anything you'd like to add on any aspect of this? Any misconceptions?
Well, there's, you know, today, a lot different than when you wrote, I've written for the Weekly View for 20 years now, a lot different than when I started. And, you know, it's easy, especially on social media, especially on the net, to think that, to read the opinions and the takes from people who, you know, want to get their two cents worth in. But, you know, there's a lot of people out there that they think they lit the fuse, and they didn't. It was people like you, Nelson. People like R.K. Scholl, Bob Collins, Ray Buhauer, people that I read, Will Huggins, they're the ones that put the work in. They're the ones that uphold journalistic standards, and they are the giants upon whose shoulders we all stand upon now.
Well, so. Thank you. Will Higgins is going to be a guest on this show in a couple weeks, my former colleague from the Indianapolis Star.
And Zach Duncan, let's not forget.
Yeah, we were talking about him before we went on the air here. One other thing I'll note to update, you alluded to this Lockerbie Church. That structure does still stand, but it was for years a Methodist. It clearly changed affiliation from what you said. It was a long time United Methodist Church, and I knew the pastor there. I live right by that church, and it's now an event center.
Right.
But it's in a very visible location.
Well, it's good that it's still standing.
We
lose a lot.
It's an event center and a coffee house, but I never knew it had the affiliation you mentioned earlier. But
now your listeners have a reason to go visit.
Yeah, that's right. Well, a fascinating subject, and again, you know, that I always say we don't whitewash history. We're try to cover all aspects of it for an honest look at what went on in our state. So we are out of time, and thanks so much to my terrific guest, Al Hunter, author and history columnist for the Weekly View newspaper. Excellent insights from you, as always. Next week, we'll explore a wide range of off-the-beaten-path sites all across Indiana. They'll include a 25-feet-tall sculpture of Bigfoot at Patoka Lake, a landmark hardware store in Jasper, and a horror-themed pizza joint in Decatur at Northeastern Indiana, not to mention a former church with more than 40 genuine Tiffany windows in Richmond, an RV museum in Elkhart, and a limestone quarry in Fort Wayne known as Indiana's Grand Canyon. My studio guest will be Jamie Ward. She's the author of the new book titled Secret Indiana, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure. So I hope you tune in next week. Thanks for sharing part of your day with us today. Let's make some Hoosier history.